All right, everyone, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to the Draft Report webinar on institutional and other barriers to providing comprehensive protection to coastal areas for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. My name is Maria Plock, and I work for the Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources. I'll be facilitating the webinar today, and we also have an AT&T technology moderator on the phone, Eddie DeLeon. So we are happy to have the following speakers on the phone today to cover policy challenges and institutional barriers. They'll be taking turns sharing information and will be available for questions at the end relating to these sections of the report, and also to have a discussion about what you've read in the report. So we will save Q&A for the end, but if you would like to chat in any questions along the way as the presenters are covering the material, please go ahead and do that. You can include the name of the person you would like to direct the question to if you want to, and send that chat to the moderator and presenters. And also just a quick note that the call will be recorded. All right, and I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Amy Geis for a welcome and brief overview. She is the Chief of the Command Center for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, as well as the Chief of Planning Division at the Corps Baltimore District.
Good afternoon. I wanted to just provide a little background to the study for the context today. The Hurricane Sandy Emergency Supplemental Bill provided up to $20 million to the Corps of Engineers for the purpose as stated on the slide. It was to conduct a comprehensive study to address the flood risks of vulnerable coastal populations in those areas affected by Hurricane Sandy. And we define that by those colored areas in the Northeast as depicted on the slide. We certainly see the purple areas, which is where the major impact area was as a result of Hurricane Sandy, but the other areas did also experience impacts from wind, surge, and other factors. As part of the appropriations, we were directed to complete and submit a report back to Congress by January 2015. So this was essentially less than a two-year time period to conduct the technical analyses and go through the formal vetting process in order to get this report to Congress. The goals of the study are to provide a risk reduction framework, which I'll comment on in a moment, and to support coastal resilient communities, and particularly looking toward future sea level rise and climate change scenarios. Our technical team is quite broad. It involves a large set of Corps of Engineers expertise and also agency subject matter experts from across these disciplines. This is not a document that is solely from a Corps of Engineers perspective, nor is it to serve only the Corps of Engineers or the mission of the Corps of Engineers. That's there may be parts of this report that do allow for that for certain analyses or projects to continue in partnership with the Corps. However, this is really to provide a coastal framework for all those in the Northeast so that we have at a regional scale a framework that's been very collaborative and looks at opportunities throughout the region. For example, looking at things such as regional sediment management as we try to balance the needs for sediment and where we might be able to reduce risk using that sediment as one example. We're looking to identify a range of potential solutions, and we will have parametric costs for some of those for those solutions in the report. And we'll also be identifying activities warranting additional analysis and social and institutional barriers. This is not a decision document, again, in terms of a traditional Corps of Engineers feasibility report. This is not going to have recommendations for site-specific construction back to Congress. So therefore, it does not include NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, documentation, or recommendations, as I say, for construction. This really sets the framework for future analyses and future studies that could have those recommendations to come out of it. As you can see by the study area, it's over 31,000 miles of shoreline, and in less than 2 years, that's quite an accomplishment to be able to look at that area and look at the possible opportunities so that we have resilient measures for our populations, infrastructure, socioeconomic conditions, and our environmental conditions.
Thanks, Amy. All right, next up we have Mark Dunning with CDM Smith, who's going to talk about the general findings of the policy challenges. Mark Dunning has over 35 years of water resources experience working at the federal level with the Army Corps of Engineers and for a number of private consulting firms. He is currently a senior water resources planner and project manager with CDM Smith in Fairfax, and he's the president of the American Water Resources Association. Mark, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Maria. Right, so today I wanted to go over the results of our analysis on identifying policy challenges and institutional barriers. And if we could skip into the next couple of slides, I'll tell you when to stop. There it is, right. So, as I say, the purpose of this this part of the study was to identify policy challenges and institutional barriers that that could hinder the ability to provide coastal storm risk management and increased community resilience in affected coastal areas. And we took a fairly broad our team took a fairly broad view of policy challenges, looking at policies, institutional barriers, and public and political barriers that might impede communities' or politicians' willingness to support hard decisions or innovative solutions. Next slide, please. Our analysis broadly focused on addressing three key questions. Basically, what are the challenges that complicate or impede the attainment of the NAAQS goals, and what policies are facilitating the attainment of those goals, and those are identified as successes. And then looking at opportunities, what priorities for action for tackling these challenges have been identified in our study. And the basic study approach was to conduct interviews with federal, state, local government officials, and we covered the NAAQS study area rather broadly and have a good representation of those officials, as well as representatives from academic institutions and stakeholder groups, to conduct literature reviews of key documents, policy documents, and studies of policy challenges, and then finally and most recently to conduct some visioning sessions. These are stakeholder workshops that have been held at various locations in the Sandy impact area. So we think we have a good understanding of the challenges, successes, and opportunities as reported from these various sources. Next slide, please. So what's the bottom line up front here? Well, in an area, as Amy said, that's got 31,000 miles of shoreline and encompasses the various states in the Northeast, the policy landscape is vast and it's complex. We're talking about a multitude of federal laws, executive orders, presidential directives, a multitude of federal agency regulations, directives, and policies, as well as their state and local counterpart regulations, laws, orders, and so forth, as well as individual community building codes and zoning ordinances. So it's a huge and complex policy landscape. We have found that there are big challenges, which I'll be talking about in a minute, but encouragingly that landscape is becoming more supportive of the risk management and resilience goals that are the foundation of the NACS study. And we also found that there are numerous ideas and recommendations that are being surfaced as part of this study for creating a more receptive policy environment that's supportive of the NACS goals. And so some of those findings are going to be presented today. Next slide, please. Based on the analysis, the reports and interviews and the workshops, six themes have emerged to classify the findings, and those themes are presented here in this slide. There's no priority order to these themes. They're all of equal importance, but we wanted to talk about each of these themes very briefly in terms of the key policy challenges, the examples of actions that are being taken to address the challenges, and those are identified as successes or partial successes, and then suggestions for improvement, opportunities for action. So let's get started with the themes. Next slide, please. The first theme focuses on establishing standards for acceptable risk and resilience, as well as harmonizing policies for reducing risk and building resiliencies. Considering the size and complexity of the policy landscape, it's not surprising that there's a lack of uniform standards for defining acceptable risk in coastal communities and infrastructure. We also found that some federal policies actually work at cross purposes with one another and possibly prevent risk management improvements. An example is FEMA's Stafford Act policies prohibit replacement of infrastructure that exceeds design requirements of destroyed infrastructure. So while you can replace something like an undersized culvert or something like that to those standards, if you try to increase its capacity for passing floodwaters, you're prevented under FEMA rules. There are some successes that we found in terms of standards. For example, the Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force has recommended a minimum standard, the advisory base flood elevation plus one, adding some freeboard to that, to serve as a minimum standard. It's not the complete answer, but it's a step in the right direction. Finally, in terms of opportunities, a lot of interest, a lot of recommendation for assembling a team of federal leaders, governors, as well as regional and local champions to try to tackle this problem of developing an appropriate standard and to harmonize and untangle federal risk management policies that may be working at cross purposes or are not doing all that they could be. There is a lot of interest in this area. Next slide, please. Communicating about risk is difficult. Risk is a difficult concept to understand and to talk about. For example, a 100-year storm. Well, what does that mean? Unfortunately, some people believe that it's something that could occur once every 100 years, and we had it last year, so we're good to go for another 99 years. There's also resistance to messages that challenge local development policies and pressures on local governments for the preservation of their tax base. It's likely that in many coastal communities, a majority of the tax base is located in the front row of houses or buildings along a beach. And things that that threaten development or affect those valued properties are considered challenges to the community's well-being. There's been some successes in improving communication and outreach about risk and resiliency. The Sea Grant program of various states was identified in many cases as a success, as well as things like communities such as Norfolk, Virginia, and others conducting local listening sessions to really work with the local community about risk and risk management issues. We see some opportunities, a need for better tools to visualize risk, to quantify and display impacts, and for more public participation, such as listening sessions, to again improve communication and understanding. Next slide, please. Risk management, building similarly to the communication, is focused here on integrating the need to integrate the varied requirements of federal dollars for rebuilding, and trying to improve the understandability and friendliness, so to speak, of those policies. It was also pointed out that the local level, where most the rubber meets the road, so to speak, as far as dealing with risk management, the press of day-to-day issues of just, you know, managing a budget and taking care of the needs of the local community often trumps the need to engage in long-range planning and deal with these broader risk management issues that just may lack the immediacy of day-to-day needs. It was also pointed out that in some cases, sequential regulatory reviews are seen as a big obstacle to implementing local risk management plans and programs that need to be to have a permit in some way or shape or form. Finally, a lot of concern at the local level about the impact of bigger waters, the flood National Flood Insurance Program modification that increases the amount of premiums somewhat drastically in some cases, and communities were worried about the economic and social impacts of the implementation of that, fearing that in some cases properties would simply be abandoned and the possibility of creating slums, in fact. So opportunities that were, well, let me mention that FEMA's community rating system was often mentioned as a good model for something, a program that incentivizes floodplain management, best management practices, because it directly impacts the bottom line. It provides additional funds or grants for that kind of behavior. Opportunities mentioned were doing something to moderate the negative impact of bigger waters, and looking at the possibility of public-private partnership opportunities for regional sediment management, and trying to rationalize the regulatory process. For example, having a joint review or streamlining the permit process to make it more user friendly, so to speak, at the local level. Next slide, please. One issue that came up frequently in our study that I want to focus on in this slide is the USACE dredge material disposal policy. This is a so-called federal standard that requires that sediments that are dredged from navigation channels and other places be disposed of according to a least cost formula. It was pointed out that this policy often misses opportunities for the use of sediments in beach nourishment if transporting the sediment to a beach or stockpiling it in a location for potential beach nourishment functions is more expensive than simply dumping the sediment outside the channel. The opportunity here is to reevaluate that federal standard for the possibility of broadening evaluation factors beyond economic lease costs to include factors such as ecosystem service benefits, public safety, and conformance with policies such as the Corps' regional sediment management policy, as well as other factors that are considered in the new principles and requirements. Next slide. Again, leadership and institutional coordination is a big issue that came up over and over. Starting at the top, it's interesting that there are at least 9 federal agencies and at least 16 congressional oversight committees that look at various aspects of coastal risk management and resiliency. There's a lack of limited coordination across congressional committees, and that in some measure cascades down to the agencies themselves. Although I think we're finding that agencies are doing a better job of collaboration and cross-coordination. But there is definitely room for improvement here. The formation of the Mitigation Framework Leadership Group and the Federal Interagency Floodplain Management Task Force are two examples of cross-agency coordination forums that are operative that can help smooth out some of the leadership coordination issues. The opportunities that have been suggested or that we found in our literature reviews is to explore developing special authorizations with perhaps a sunset provision for the Sandy area with the mission of harmonizing agency policies and addressing agency silo challenges that conflict with reducing risk and improving resiliency. Such an authorization could actually be part of a upcoming Water Resources Development Act, for example. And also, in perhaps in combination with this type of special authorization, explore fostering interagency pilot projects that are collaborative in nature. Next slide, please. Generally speaking, there are very good reasons that individual agency policies are the way they are. Every agency is extremely interested in safeguarding its fiduciary responsibilities and ensuring that the funds that it is entrusted with are used to the best possible ability. However, that being said, individual agency policies sometimes conflict and they sometimes complicate interagency partnerships that are focused on regional or watershed solutions. If policies don't specifically authorize interagency cooperation, then they're likely to be not be countenanced. Other complicating factors are that in many cases local cost share requirements for developing projects are carrying out programs under some federal authority. Other federal dollars cannot be used to for the local cost share. There are some exceptions, but very few. So these kinds of challenges might be met through through more public-private partnerships, through something like the disaster relief appropriation as a model, which authorized funding across agencies. So there's room for opportunity here for working on new ways of harmonizing agency policies. I think that would be it there. And I wanted to focus quickly on the updates from the visioning sessions. The visioning sessions have been conducted over the past several months, and again, they're being conducted with stakeholders at in various locations across the Sandy area. The sessions with stakeholders have generally reaffirmed the conclusions reported already in the webinar and in the report, but some emphases that seem to come up frequently in these sessions, again, were the need for regional approaches to help combat the parochial focuses on that complicate risk management. The need for more accommodating funding mechanisms, the need for more informed and engaged publics, the public that has a greater understanding of risk management issues and building resiliency. And there was quite a support for additional listening sessions and other forms of outreach. And finally, the need for greater interagency collaboration and coordination across program authorities. Next slide, please. So, in summary, the policy analysis that we have conducted thus far is a complex and broad topic, but some of the more important things that have emerged from that, conclusions that have emerged are, number one, the need for standards. Number two, the need for integrated approaches, regional approaches. Number three, the need for leadership to really help to untangle things and to encourage and build collaboration across agencies and across programs. The need for improved tools for communicating risk and identifying impacts, and of course, finally, funding, the need for funding oriented to mitigation versus recovering from disasters. It's better to plan forward than to pick up the pieces afterwards, as has been noted. So that concludes my presentation on the policy challenges analysis thus far. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Definitely appreciate it. Just a quick note to everybody else. If you have any questions that came to mind during Mark's presentation, please go ahead and put them into the chat box. You can use that send note button at the top of your screen and send it to the presenters. And then when we get to the Q&A session at the end, we'll be looking at the questions in the chat box in the order that we receive them. And thanks to those of you who have already sent in some questions. Next up, we have Emily Buxton, who's going to talk about the policy challenges related to natural and nature-based infrastructure. Emily is a biologist at IWR at the Institute for Water Resources here at the Corps of Engineers. Previously, she served as a NOAA Canal Sea Grant Fellow with the Engineer Research and Development Center at the Corps of Engineers headquarters. Currently at the Corps, she supports a number of coastal, environmental, and navigation initiatives at the Institute for Water Resources and the Engineer Research and Development Center. She has previously served in policy advising and technical positions at the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service. Emily, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. For those of you who attended our Policy Barriers talk in December, this presentation will look very familiar to you. Today, I'm going to give you some updates on some of the activities and the progress we've made on these activities. And we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end. So if you wanted to talk about the report specifically and not the findings from this workshop, then I'd be more than happy to answer questions on that. Today, I'll give you an overview of what natural and nature-based features are for those of you who are a little bit new to this, and describe our November policy workshop and some of the findings from that. Next slide, please. The Corps released a Coastal Risk Reduction and Resilience Report in July of 2013, which recognized that the Corps supports an integrated planning approach that combines the use of natural, nature-based, non-structural, and structural measures to increase resilience and reduce risk. Next slide, please. When we're talking about natural and nature-based features, we're referring to features such as dunes, beaches, submerged aquatic vegetation, oyster and coastal reefs, barrier islands, and maritime forests, among other features. Next slide. The main difference between natural and nature-based features is that natural features are created and evolve over time through the actions of physical, biological, geological, and chemical processes, while nature-based features may mimic natural features but are primarily created through human design, engineering, and construction. Next slide. As part of the NACS, we knew that there were policy challenges and barriers to implementing NNBS, which is what we refer to natural and nature-based features. To understand what these were, we held a workshop in November of last year, and we invited 34 participants from a variety of federal agencies listed on the left side of the screen to discuss what they believed the barriers to implementing NNBS were and how we could address them together. Next slide. We asked the participants to consider the following questions and answer them in small breakout groups. These small breakout groups then reported their findings back to the larger group, at which point we had a larger discussion together. We asked participants to consider, 1, what were the most significant policy challenges related to the implementation of NNBF? What changes in existing policy would have to be made to encourage the greater use of NNBF? 2, what actions could be taken to improve coordination among the federal, local, and state agencies that implement NNBF? We also asked participants to self-reflect on what changes could occur within their own agencies. 3, we knew that uncertainties and information gaps impeded the implementation of NNBF, and question 3 sought to understand what these were and how we could address them. Finally, we asked participants how communication could be improved among individuals and organizations who work on NNBF. Next slide. And so now I'll share with you some of the key findings and opportunities that participants from this workshop had identified. First of all, almost all participants recognize that there are severe knowledge and data deficiencies related to NNBF. There is uncertainty regarding these features' performance. For instance, how much of a storm surge from a Category 3 hurricane will a specific march reduce? In many cases, this is unclear. Two, there are data deficiencies regarding timing. For instance, if we construct a marsh, how soon after its construction will it begin to perform as expected? Scale is an issue. To protect a community from a Category 2 nor'easter, for example, how many acres of wetlands and other NNBF solutions are needed? Life cycle costs to operate and maintain, which are relatively well known for structural solutions, are less well known for NNBF solutions. The effects that sea level rise and climate change have on these features is also often uncertain. Policies and researches and science are needed to address all of these deficiencies. Participants recognize that there are uncertainties related to NNBF ecosystem goods and services as well. Specifically, the kinds of ecosystem goods and services and the extent of ecosystem goods and services provided by NNBF are generally poorly understood. We need the means to perform full evaluations of the complete range of ecosystem goods and services provided by NNBF. Policies are needed that will inform cost-benefit valuations of the ecosystem goods and services provided by NNBF. There is also a need for policies that address how to consider non-monetizable benefits and direction on how to monetize these benefits. And I'd like to just state that, you know, although the participants recognize there is a lot of deficiencies and unknowns, all of the agencies present are doing research on all of these topics, and so work is ongoing. There's a lot of different initiatives to understand all of these issues. Next slide, please. Participants stated time and time again that adaptive management was needed to properly manage NNBF and determine its effectiveness. However, they also stated that many federal agencies lack funding and clear mandates to conduct adaptive management. Participants believe that adaptive management can be impeded by NEPA requirements, although many regulatory individuals said that some of these issues can be resolved through the use of a tiered or programmatic approach. Some participants also noted that municipalities face unique challenges with policies that impede the application of adaptive management. For example, they might be penalized if they reported results that were below the launch. Next slide, please. Although participants identified a number of significant barriers to the implementation of NNBF, they also identified a number of potential opportunities and solutions for resolving these barriers. Almost all participants identified the need for demonstration projects, case studies, best practices, and guidance documents on NNBF. They also stated that there's a need to communicate more effectively and transparently between the government, stakeholders, and the general public. It's also necessary for us to create risk and resiliency and NNBF performance metrics. I would like to note that our team recognizes this last opportunity specifically and is already working on creating these metrics. Next slide, please. Participants also recognized a number of leadership and institutional coordination challenges. For instance, many participants who work frequently with local land agencies noted that land use planning and zoning policies often do not encourage and sometimes limit the use of NNBF. Core participants at the workshop specifically noted that all USAID flood and coastal storm damage reduction projects require a cost-sharing partner, and aligning the budgets and schedules for these cost-sharing partnerships is an ongoing challenge. Many participants also stated that planning and regulatory activities have to be integrated and coordinated better between the various agencies that are involved before decisions and investments are finalized to make sure that we come up with the best solutions possible. Many participants also noted that projects are often regulated on a case-by-case basis that precludes the development of comprehensive, programmatic, regional, landscape, or system-focused projects. And many of our participants also worked for agencies that have very strict policies regarding wetlands, threatened and endangered species, and essential fish habitats specifically. For NNBF projects that involve or impact any of these resources, policies are needed that support efficient communication and decision-making both within and among federal agencies. We also had many participants discuss coordination on emergency response specifically. Some participants noted that existing authorities restrict what can be built using emergency funds. Additionally, many participants noted that after emergencies, projects are built to pre-disaster conditions, which may not be the most resilient option. Rebuilding efforts and aid provided after emergencies should be provided in a more strategic manner to create more resilient solutions. There also currently exists a gap in coordination between the emergency response, recovery, and mitigation communities that should and could be addressed to create more resilient solutions following disasters. Although participants identified a number of barriers, they also listed a number of opportunities to address these barriers. Like Mark was saying earlier, Sea Grant and the silver jackets are both mechanisms that exist that could address some of the barriers listed. Additionally, public-private partnerships could be created that could work to implement NNBF. Guidance and policies are needed to promote coordination and data sharing among the agencies. This is an ongoing need for all of this work. NNBF should be incorporated into current decision support and communications tools that agencies utilize. Partnerships and funding should also be a leverage to support NNBF. And finally, a guidebook could be developed with information on NNBF that could be implemented during the process following disaster. Again, I'd like to state that our team is also working on this recommendation specifically now. Next slide, please. One of the questions we asked participants specifically was to address the communication and outreach barriers to implementing NNBF. Of these, participants stated that there's a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to definitions of NNBF. For example, some agencies define green infrastructure as stormwater infrastructure, while other agencies refer to it as what we would typically refer to as NNBF. Common definitions for NNBF or green infrastructure or nature-based infrastructure should be developed that would enable interested parties to communicate more effectively about these features. While the costs and benefits of traditional structural methods are well understood, the costs and benefits of NNBF are not as well understood. To be able to utilize NNBF more frequently, we need to be able to quantify these costs and benefits. Additionally, clear and concise language about the benefits of NNBF is needed to compare these features to the more traditional structural methods. Communication, again, was another issue that came up time and time again and how it needed to be improved between the various levels of government, not just within a federal agency or multiple federal agencies, but between federal, state, and local levels of government. Outreach and communications should also target private interests and homeowners to determine the type of projects that need to implement on their land. Next slide. Participants listed a number of opportunities to address the barriers that they identified. For example, they noted that the development of a policy digest with relevant definitions of NNBF, as well as the authority roles and responsibilities of all of the agencies that have jurisdiction or interest in the implementation of NNBF, would be helpful in helping the partners understand NNBF more fully and getting it implemented more frequently. They also noted that NNBF community practice could be formed to share best practices and knowledge on these features. And finally, they noted that the federal government was not the only entity implementing these features. There's a need to educate private interest and landowners on these features. And again, I'd like to note that since the completion of this workshop, our team is actually working on all of the opportunities listed on this slide. And that's it for me. I'm happy to answer any questions. Lauren Leich is also here, and so we can talk about any questions specifically. If you have any specific technical questions about NNBF, we are having a workshop on Thursday where we have some of our senior scientists working on it who will be available to answer more specific technical questions. But I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Great. Thanks, Emily. So I think at this point we will go ahead and move into the Q&A session. Just as you guys know, Emily did mention that Lauren Leich is also a resource on the phone here at the Institute for Water Resources to talk about some of this content. And we also have Dave Robbins, who is the project manager for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, on the line if there are any questions for them. So I will just, Eddie, I'm going to pass it over to you in a minute just to review how to ask a question and how to raise your hand. And then just for everybody on the line, we'll be going through the questions in order that we see them in the chat box. And and one of the things I wanted to mention first, there's been a couple questions already about the slides and their availability. So you'll find on the current website a version of this presentation that was given before, but the updated version will be posted on the website soon. So just keep an eye out there. That just wanted to clarify for you all. So Eddie, do you want to just go through how to ask a question again, please?
Absolutely. So as a quick reminder to all of our participants, if you would like to submit a question via chat, you may use the Send Note button at the top of your screen or the chat box and address your questions to all moderators or presenters. If you prefer to ask a question or make a comment over the phone lines, you may dial *1 on your phone and you'll be notified line is unmuted, at which point you may proceed to state your name and your question. Again, if you prefer to ask a question or make a comment over the phone lines, you may dial star 1 on your phone and you will be notified once your line is unmuted.
Great. Thanks, Eddie. So I'll go ahead and start with a question that we got during Mark's presentation. So Mark Dunning, I'll direct this one to you. It's from Jerry Galloway, and he says, Mark mentioned a need for regional authority to enforce regulations, planning, et cetera. Are there examples of such regional authorities being given enforcement authority? What is being suggested?
I'm looking at the, I have a different one, Maria. Maybe I'm looking in the wrong spot, but the question I see from Jerry Galloway says, what group should decide on acceptable risk for a given community? Is it a national standard or local, or should there be a standard at all? Do you have that question?
Mark, that is fine. I think he probably sent that question directly to you. So if you want to answer that one first, and then I can read off the second one to you again after.
Oh, okay.
No worries.
Okay, great. Well, the question that I'm responding to right now reads, what group should decide on acceptable risk for a given community? Is it a national standard or local, or should there be a standard at all? That, of course, is a tricky issue. The idea of acceptable risk has to consist of a couple of parts, a baseline level, such as what the Sandy Rebuilding Task Force recommended as the ABFE plus one as kind of a minimum standard for risk. But possibly for a community or for a region or group of communities, there possibly needs to be a more deliberative process. What I'd almost see something in the Corps of Engineers, which is called shared vision planning, a deliberative process to look at the alternatives with a good understanding of the impacts and various courses of action that proceed from different types of standards, but with the idea that a community or a group of communities ultimately decides in a deliberative fashion on what the appropriate acceptable level of risk for their community is, whether it be the baseline level that is kind of the bottom line standard or something else. That would be my answer anyway.
Thanks, Mark. And let me just then read off the other question for you. I think it should be in your chat box. I forwarded it to you, also from Jerry Galloway, but let me just read it again here. He says, Mark mentioned the need for regional authority to enforce regulations and planning. Are there examples of such regional authorities being given enforcement authority? What is being suggested?
Okay. A couple of times in our study, we heard examples focused on river basin commissions, something like the Delaware River Basin Commission, the Susquehanna. They're regional authorities that have been constituted under federal rules that have rather significant enforcement authorities for certain purposes. And this was this model was brought to our attention as something that perhaps should be considered going forward for dealing with risk management and resiliency building on a regional level.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark. All right, so the next question was actually just a quick clarification for Emily Buxton during her presentation. So Emily, it's Stuart Baker. He asked, let's see, was her reference to a Cat 2 nor'easter actually to a Cat 2 hurricane?
Yeah, that was me misspeaking. I was just trying to include an example to say what I meant about what scale was. And I'm actually a Floridian, so I'm more familiar with hurricanes and nor'easters anyway, so I should have said that. I'm sorry.
All right, then we have a comment from David Russ. Let me just read it off. He says, regarding regional coordination and leadership, we can also mention the development of MOUs, such as the one currently being formed between the Corps of Engineers and Department of Interior for Fire Island. Also, we have been using MASPO, the Mid-Atlantic Federal Partners for the Ocean, to assist in federal coordination efforts. So thanks for your comment, Dave. Emily or Mark, did you have any response to David?
No, other than to note that, yes, that's a good point. I agree.
Okay. And then the next question is from Ellen McCray. And Ellen, I know you also noted that you'd be happy to chime in on federal partnerships. So if at any point you want to make any comments, please just hit that star one and raise your hand and jump in to the discussion. So the specific question, though, I think I'll pass on to Emily. She says, Emily McCray says, did your research on barriers include any discovery of regional-level coordination of federal agencies? Did you find those to be valuable or effective at addressing the gap in coordination?
A lot of people we talked to about the NMDF barriers specifically didn't mention a lot of different regional options, like Sea Grant or like regional sediment management, which we have in the core. You know, a couple of other agencies mentioned some of their regional options that they had, and they had identified those as potential places where we could address the barriers. They didn't really go into any farther than that, but yeah, a lot of people were very, you know, said very nice things about all the various regional programs that either they have or we have we have together.
Excellent. And Mark, what about you? Any comments?
The one that comes to mind was the idea that the Hurricane Sandy task force was a really good model for bringing together diverse federal agencies, diverse programs into one group and working through under presidential level leadership some of the issues. This probably is not what the questioner was thinking of, but this was one that was mentioned a number of occasions as what it might take to really more effectively deal with harmonizing some of these policies as opposed to, you know, more local or ad hoc kinds of coordination mechanisms.
Great, thanks, Mark. And I saw a hand go up while you were talking, and I wonder if it might be Ellen or someone else on the topic of regional coordination and partnership. So, Eddie, if you could go ahead and unmute the person whose hand is raised, we can just jump in. And if it's a separate question, that's fine, too.
Yes, that is actually indeed Ellen. Let me go ahead and unmute that
line. Great, thanks.
Okay, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity. Dave and I actually work together, so I think it was an interesting question from Dave Russ as well, and his calling out of the Mid-Atlantic Federal Partners for the Ocean, which is one of the groups that is coordinating across coastal issues specifically. And then I just wanted to add in a couple of other federal agency partnerships. One is the New England Federal Partners, which has been meeting for nearly a decade now and coordinates across 16 different federal agencies across a number of issues, including coastal issues and climate change, as well as ocean planning. And then a rather new one on the scene is the Federal Climate Partners for the Mid-Atlantic, which is working to coordinate with that Sandy Task Force, among others. But I agree that, you know, with the speaker, that Sandy Task Force is one that had a lot of mandates behind it, And I think that these other ones that I mentioned are more kind of volunteer and are still facing some of the barriers that you mentioned, and that is the ability to pool funding, quite honestly, to actually execute projects together. So for now, it's more of a communication and coordination and a collaboration, shall I say.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks for jumping in, Ellen. And I've got a few other comments here, but I'm going to go to one I just got recently because it also ties into this discussion and answers a previous question, which is from Mark Slaughter, who says, one example of regional land use regulatory authority is the New Jersey Meadowlands Commission. And he gives a link there to the website. Mark, do you can you send that link to everybody, or I can at the end I can forward that around. Okay, so let me go back up to some of the comments. I see another hand raised, so it might be on the same topic. So let's go to the phones again, and then I'll continue on with the other topics.
Sorry, Maria, that was actually still Ellen's line.
Oh, okay. So no hands?
No hands, that's correct.
Okay. All right, so then just so some comments here that were raised. Matthew Wall says, FYI, mitigation funding is allowed as part of public assistance available after a presidentially declared disaster. It's referred to as 406 mitigation. And he also makes the comment, an NBF is perceived in many jurisdictions as being business unfriendly due to anticipated increased restrictions on development. As such, this concern of a known loss often overrides the concept of future potential loss. This is especially true of jurisdictions which are geographically limited or cannot be annexed. So thank you for those comments, Matthew. I'll just check with Emily and Mark to see if there are any responses or reactions.
I think your comments on, NNBF being business unfriendly are probably true, or certainly how some people feel. I think a lot of it, what our participants recognize is that a lot of it has to do with communication with local communities and just kind of informing them about what it can provide, what it can't provide, why it's important. And so I certainly think, more communication on all of the, performance needs, the use of it, the benefits of it, I think would probably alleviate some of those issues.
Mark, do you have anything to add?
No, I think Emily summed it up very well.
Okay. All right, so the next question is from Eric Myers. He says, a couple of speakers offered examples of specific barriers or conflicting mandates. Will the final North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study catalog as many specific conflicts, for example, female rules on rebuilding? Will it catalog as many specific conflicts as possible, or simply include illustrative examples in making general statements about places to improve coastal protection? So, Emma, let me start with you on that one and see if we need to ask Dave or anybody else.
Yeah, certainly we have a policy chapter of the main report, which includes all the findings that Mark and I had. And additionally, in the Natural Nature-Based Features Appendix, which is a couple hundred pages long, there's another section on the MNBF policy barriers that's a little broader than what's in the main report. And so in both of those sections, we do talk about some of the specific conflicts in more detail than we offered in this presentation. The actual report is, many pages long rather than what we can give here. So I think hopefully once you see the report, you'll be happy with some of the examples and conflicts that we do mention. And I'm sure other parts of the report actually talk about conflicts as well, but I know definitely in the policy section you'll see it.
Mark, did you have anything else to add?
No, once again, Emily covered it very well.
All right. Okay, so then we have another person who wrote in about another example of partnerships. This is from David Russ. He says, another option at the municipal level are the urban water federal partnerships. Partnerships include 5 municipalities, watersheds across the area impacted by Sandy, New Jersey, the Delaware, the Bronx, and Harlem Rivers, Mystic River, Boston, and that there are 14 federal agencies involved with that partnership. So let me just check. I don't have any other questions at this moment in my chat box, but I want to check with the presenters in case anybody has chatted to you directly with any questions to address. So none for Emily. Mark, do you have any others that have chatted in directly to you?
No, I'd just like to thank the questioners. There are some good nuggets of information that, you know, frankly, for example, the last one, that's good to know. We'll take a look at that and, you know, as appropriate, add it to our report.
And Mark, just so you know, we're taking notes here at IWR, so we'll be sending around all of these comments as well as the discussion afterwards. So just a reminder, if you have another question for anyone, please use the send note button at the top of your screen to chat it in, or if you'd like to add any additional information or make any comments about this or the report, or you have any questions and you want to talk, just hit that star one and raise your hand and we will call on you.
And like I said, if you have actually seen the report and read it, we're happy to, you know, take your comments on it or, you know, what you thought or whether you're angry at us or really happy with us or whatever.
So we'll just give it a few more minutes to see if any other questions come in or if anybody wants to raise their hand. All right, everyone. Well, I'm not seeing any other questions come in. Mark, any other questions coming in to your chat box?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, then I think at this point we will go ahead and wrap up the webinar. I just want to thank the speakers for joining and presenting that information, and also thanks very much to everybody for calling in and the good questions and especially the information that you provided. With that, thanks again, and this concludes our webinar.